and welcome to CISPA TLDR, the podcast from the CISPA Helmholtz Center for Information Security. We break down cybersecurity and AI in plain language, no computer science degree required. Every month, we chat with our researchers about the challenges they're tackling. I'm Tobias Ebelshäuser from our communications department, and just so you know, I am not a computer scientist either. And these latest episodes are a little bit special, as CISPA researchers are preparing to present their latest findings at USENIX 2025, one of the most important conferences in security and privacy. So I have decided to interview a few of these authors and get them to explain what they'll be telling to their colleagues in Seattle. So my guest today is Shubham Agarwal, a PhD student here at CISPA. Shubham joined CISPA in 2021 and has been focusing on browser security since. Thanks for stopping by, Shubham.
Yeah, Tobias, thanks so much for having me here.
So, Shubham, you've been with CISPA for a while, and your latest USENIX paper is your third one at a top-tier conference, which at CISPA marks the beginning of the end of your PhD journey here. Maybe let's talk about how did you like it here, and what would you say makes CISPA so special for PhDs like you are?
That's a great question. I mean, when I started... So I joined the university as a master's student back in 2018. Well, at that point, I had no idea about, you know, the cybersecurity of things and what's going on in this arena. But I was lucky here, lucky to be part, you know, or to be around CISPA back then when I was doing my master's. And that's how I kind of, you know, got to know about CISPA. And then I did my master thesis with Ben Stock, who is also my supervisor during my time at PhD. And I just loved everything about the kind of research that I've been doing for a while now. I mean, I started in 2021 that you mentioned, and the quality of the research that usually is, you know, day-to-day things that we are part of, like, I just enjoy doing that. And that has been the highlight of my PhD. If I have to just summarize this, why did I choose CISPA, or why am I here? Like, I just love the quality of work that we do here.
Okay. Okay. So maybe let's get right to that research that you love so much, because now, as you're traveling to Seattle soon, as the other papers, your latest paper that you will be presenting in Seattle focuses on security and privacy aspects of browser extensions. Now, for people like me who don't spend their lives thinking about browser extensions or browser security, what are they? What are these extensions, and why do they matter?
Okay, cool. Yeah. Browser extensions are, you know, these are very popular things nowadays. So everyone must have, you know, or must be using web on a daily basis. So whenever we have to, you know, search about something, we just open our web browsers and then search about those things and do so many more than that. So many more things than that, right? I mean, looking back 10 or 20 years ago, these browsers used to have like limited functionalities. What we used to do there was, you know, just visit certain pages, do our things, and then go back. Nowadays, they can do so many more. Like, they can allow you to store your data, like passwords and such. They can allow you to store your bookmarks. You can come back to them and then soon visit to the same page again and, you know, also store data. I think the core fundamental principle there is more focused towards extensibility and customization. The point being that every user can use the web browser as and when they want to. That's where these browser extensions, you know, come into focus, because they can really very well adapt to the individual needs or needs of group of people who want to use their browser the way they can. So imagine you want to use password managers, right? You don't want to store your, you know, passwords in the browser itself or the website, but you can use a password manager like Bitwarden or anything.
Yeah.
Which is like extremely popular among, you know, technical people, but I know that a lot of non-technical people also nowadays use password managers like Bitwarden. And then you see ads everywhere.
Yeah.
What do? You probably install one of these ad blockers, which are extremely famous. By the way, these are also browser extensions. So these are extremely cool and popular among all the users on the web. But that's where it gets more interesting, because they can really monitor or do a lot more than monitor than what you're actually using these web browsers for. So, for example, you can do all the things that you do on your banking website, and then you have your browser extension watching everything that you do there. So that's where the privacy and security also comes into the picture.
All right. But that, what you just described, sounds like these these extensions are very powerful in a way, but that might also make them risky, right? Because as you see, they see everything that you're doing on the web. So I think that gives them a lot of a potential for abuse, right?
Yes, exactly. I mean, they're being called nowadays like double-edged sword, rightly mm-hmm. for that reason, because they really help the users to achieve so many things that was not possible before. But then you know, the same tool or the same sword can be abused to cause a lot of damages. Yeah. And that's very much the problem.
Yeah, okay, okay. But how did you get into this line of research, and what were you hoping to find? You are probably aware that they are doing a lot more, or could be doing a lot more than they're supposed to.
Yeah, right. So now that I think about this, I mean, I was, as I mentioned, like I was doing my master thesis with Ben Stock, and basically the research group here of Ben mm-hmm. mostly focuses on client-side security of web in itself. And back then, I was thinking about, okay, if I want to do my PhD or continue doing the research that I love so much, what exactly do I need to do? Even before that, when I finished my bachelor's and I was actually working for a software product company back in India, and you know, one of my tasks was to build a browser extension to achieve something which was extremely painful for the product itself to do. And that was my first exposure to browser extensions, okay, by the way. And I had no idea about what I was doing. I was just, you know, following the orders, if you want to call it, or, you know, just trying to write a piece of code which helps the product in a certain way. I was able to do that, but when I, you know, came here during my master's studies, when I was actually exposed to the security side of things, I was taking this web security lecture, that actually made me think what I was doing back then in my job was not actually secure. And browser extensions are actually powerful, rightly, as you mentioned, and they could do a lot more damage than, you know, the thing that I was exposed to at my work. And that's where this whole, you know, you want to call it this curiosity or inquisitiveness kicked in, and I said, like, okay, let's look into this.
Yeah, okay. And you actually found a few things, right? So that's why you wrote three papers about it.
Yeah, that's right.
So maybe let's start with your first paper, because as is usual, these papers kind of build on each other. So you start with something and then you continue your line of research. So let's get back to the first one before getting into what is like brand new. In your first paper, you looked at how extensions interfere with security headers. Can you explain what security headers are and why they are important for protecting users?
Sure. Well, if I have to explain this, you know, maybe in a more generic level, I would say, mm-hmm. like, just imagine you throw a party at your home and you invite a lot of people, mm-hmm. all your friends, but then you explicitly mention that only bring your, you know, spouses or girlfriends or boyfriends, right? Yeah. Don't bring your pets.
Okay.
So, because somebody at home is allergic to pets.
Okay.
No offense to pets. I love
them. I'm allergic to cats, but so still have cats. So, yeah.
Well, so, yeah, I mean, in this situation, basically, it's kind of analogous to how security headers work. So you visit, let's say, shubham.com, and the shubham.com website comes with a set of rules, which are basically fused into these secure like headers, basically. Yeah. So whenever you visit my website, I send a lot of security headers dictating that, you know, you can only do so many things on the client side. Mm-hmm. So basically, I wish and desire certain rules mm-hmm. for my users, and I send it as part of the headers. In the same way that I ask my, you know, colleagues and friends to not bring pets, because I don't want people to get allergic to it. So these are basically set of rules that websites impose mm-hmm. when the content is actually loaded on the website, on your browser.
Okay.
So that's pretty much how these security headers work, and like these headers work, and when it, you know, is essentially security related, like what sort of JavaScript you might mm-hmm. be able to load, or what sort of iframes you mm-hmm. want to allow loading on the mm-hmm. client side, then it's kind of security critical. Mm-hmm. And then that's why we call them security headers, which control these actions or restrictions.
Okay. Okay. And in your paper, you found that some extensions are smuggling in pets in their handbag. So continuing with that metaphor. So some are undermining these protections.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, maybe one thing to mention before even I dive into what we found there was, so the idea there was, yeah, we know that, you know, extensions are extremely powerful and then they can, you know, be an adversary and then they could abuse whole lot of things that they can do on the client side, right? But one of the assumptions that we had was even benign extensions or like, you know, extensions like malware bytes or password managers, they need to do certain things in order to function. And this could itself even be detrimental or in some way questionable or dangerous, we call them. So this is what our assumption there was. And we still went ahead and tried to understand how many extensions or were even after any of the security headers. And then we found like over 1,000 of them to be, you know, kind of modifying security headers. Like most popular of them being the content security policy, which is very, very critical to the websites on the client side because it kind of, you know, restricts what scripts, JavaScripts you could load and, you know, so many other things like HTTPS upgrade and such.
Okay.
And then, of course, you know, you just look into these numbers and you find, oh my God, 1,000 extensions are doing this and they're also extremely popular. And the assumption there was this could even be benign behavior or, you know, benign intention rather than benign behavior. So we tried to understand this in a bit involved way. And we looked into some of these extensions manually even to understand why it happens, right? And we found out that there might even be legitimate cases because, you know, it's like websites and browsers, they are moving towards more security or security by design is imperative these days. And that's what we all advocate for even. So no questions asked there. This might even hinder with how browser extensions work.
Right? Okay.
So they might want to do something like, you know, allow you to store your bookmarks or store passwords. But the website is so tight in terms of its security that it doesn't allow browser extension. So all these browser extensions have to resort to is like, okay, fine. We do some damage, but only for functionality because that's what the user wants.
Okay, okay, okay. So it's not even intentional that they're like intentional in a way, yes, but not like maliciously intentional that they're like circumventing this these security headers.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's where, you know, it gets hard to draw a line because you observe certain actions to be to be exhibited by these extensions, but then you only try and find out what the reason behind it is through manual analysis or actually, you know, continuously monitoring what happens.
Yeah.
So if you're talking about 10 or 100 extensions, it might be feasible. If you're talking about 100,000 or 200,000 extensions, it gets a bit more complicated there. Mm-hmm.
And it's also very hard for like the average user to get like informed consent about that, you know, to know that, okay, this extension might be hurting my security because they are not, might not even be aware of that.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, looking at the things from, you know, the lens of what I've seen in like past 4 years or so, I mean, also the system or the structure of these distribution store is such that it's hard to convey all the information to the users. I mean, I'm talking from my technical perspective here because I've been looking into this for a while. But if I was an average user, when I'm installing an extension, what is the information, bit of information that I'm going to look for?
Yeah.
It's hard to, you know, kind of draw pointers there, like what is interesting to everyone. Yeah.
And what can the average user even grasp? Yeah, because that's, who knows what a security header is, right? So
that's even a bigger problem. Yeah. Like you cannot expect everyone to know everything.
Yeah.
That's just way out of scope.
Yeah, definitely. So the solution would be to then make sure they don't hurt the security headers. But
yeah, I mean, well, yes and no.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the recommendations that we also put in the paper is like, try and explore other alternatives whenever it's possible. Of course, it's hard to, you know, kind of generalize this because some extensions might just have to do certain things. And we kind of tried to reach out to developers to even understand what they feel about the things that we flagged. as suspicious or dangerous.
Yeah.
Some of them even reported back to us that, okay, fine, we did not really think about this as an issue, but now that you say about it, thanks so much, and we will figure out a way to, you know, kind of fix it.
Okay, okay.
But then there were some other people who mentioned that, well, we need this because, you know, websites
don't... It's just our product. Yeah.
It's just a product, right?
Yeah, okay.
And it's complicated. So I think a bit of transparency there would not hurt.
Yeah.
I mean, what developers could definitely do is like just be transparent about something in the description of the extension from their side at least, and then users can make an educated decision. Of course, I'm not expecting everyone to, you know, kind of understand this, but some note or disclaimer definitely helps.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, makes sense. I mean, it's also a case of how much damage could they really do? Did you find out something about that? Did you like identify real risks that users might be facing when they're using, one of these extensions that you found changing the security headers?
Yes, actually, one that I could remember is there was the developer actually kind of reached out to us as well after receiving a notification. Is there was an extension which was trying to drop the important CSP header on a specific set of websites, which, you know, so for example, if I'm using a Facebook share extension, hypothetically speaking, theoretically, this extension should only operate on Facebook.com.
Yeah.
Because, well, why would it operate on Google.com, right? But this extension was actually dropping the CSP header on all the websites.
CSP meaning content security
policy. The content security policy header, right. And when we reached out to the developer, they mentioned that this actually was a bug or, you know, a misconfiguration from their side. They did not realize that this extension was actually, you know, doing so much damage than it was supposed to.
Okay.
Or, you know, not damage so much that they intended to do, but it was actually harming their users on all the websites.
Yeah.
And I think they fixed out they fixed that bug like in a span of 3 weeks or so.
Okay,
I could figure out. Yeah.
Okay, so your work actually made at least a few of these extensions more secure.
Yeah, I mean, we actually looked into this behavior across 3 years. So basically, we looked into what extensions we're doing in 2020, 2021, and then also in 2022 when the paper was accepted, and we saw this behavior to be kind of, you know, persistent, at least in all these 3 years. And then, you know, some preliminary analysis afterwards in 2023, we saw a drop. Of course, it wasn't like, you know, going back from 100 to 70% or 60%, but it was still good enough, I would say.
Okay, okay. And yeah, I mean, you found over 1,000 extensions really doing this. So that's quite a lot. So anything helps, I'd say.
I hope so.
Was there something that particularly surprised you when you like went to the extension store and saw that so many damage is being done?
Yeah, I think one thing that interested me a lot, I think this is also related to kind of my follow-up works, what I tried to do there. The interesting bit there was when we reached out to the developers and the response, of course, we did not get, you know, responses from all the 1,000 extensions or 1,000 plus extension developers.
Yeah, yeah.
Those were very limited. I think 30 responses at best, which is not a lot. But then these were already very interesting because some of them said like, yeah, okay, we understand the problem we already have. It's just that we can't do much about it.
Okay.
And that led us to think that what are the other problems then that developer might even know about it, but still have to do, like keep it in their code, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's one thing. And the other thing was like, oh, oops, that was a misconfiguration.
Yeah.
And yeah, again, because these are not overtly malicious behaviors.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
So they're not actually trying to do damage by intent, but it just happened.
Yeah. It really makes you think because even there are a lot of malicious actors on the internet and even that so many people are just trying to do their best and still like just making human mistakes, which can lead to some serious damage on the user's machines or like lead them to losing their data or something.
Yep, totally. I mean,
yeah. Okay. But I think like losing data is a good segue to your second paper, which focused more on privacy, because you found that even in private browsing and when blocking all of the cookies, some extensions can give you away, identify you as a user. How does that work? What did you find?
Okay, I mean, talking about my second paper, which is basically about fingerprinting, right? So the idea behind that was like, okay, you could be very private on your web browsing behavior. Like you don't allow third-party cookies to be set, or you use incognito mode to, you know, browse on your bank so that you nobody listens to you or whatever. Yeah. But then these browser extensions might just be sitting on your browser, leaking information or bits of, you know, these information about you, which when, you know, when you combine them, it gives away a perfect picture, perfect profile to these trackers. So what I've been trying to tell here is, like, you don't tell your, when you're roaming in the market, you don't give away, you know, your SSN number or whatever, your name or your address to anyone.
Yeah.
But some people just might track you or, you know, fingerprint you based on the cloth, the color of the cloth that you're wearing, basically. Like the fancy hat or, I don't know, the
something identifiable.
Exactly, right? So, and the problem there is most people or, you know, an average user won't even guess that this password management extension or, you know, Google Translate extension would leak such an information that would be allowed or that would be observed by trackers. And then it gives away, you know, that you visited a certain website.
Yeah.
So this is an interesting bit to a lot of trackers and fingerprinters these days, because of course the traditional means to fingerprint users has been, you know, cut down a lot because of course privacy. There's been so much research about, you know, kind of limiting these behaviors. So cookies and, you know, these are getting more and more boring, I would say.
Yeah.
Don't quote me on that, but people say that. So, of course, you know, these tracking companies and whatever, like they're being very creative and they're trying to find new ways already.
So, yeah, the biggest use case for tracking is usually ads, probably, right? So people want to find out what you're interested in. They want to see, okay, what can I sell to this person most efficiently? And that's why they have to get so creative when browsers like try to protect you. They have to work around these protections.
Yes. So I mean, ad definitely is like one very big component of this whole tracking industry, because it gives away, like it provides money. Like it's a monetization factor.
Yeah.
Right. So of course that is one thing. I was talking to a journalist at some point of time, and I basically trying to understand like how fingerprinting affects them, right? Like in general, like being tracked on the web. And they were, the journalist was like really impressed by just knowing the fact that an extension could even contribute to this behavior, because, you know, some people who just want to be, you know, not recognized.
Okay.
If you're doing, you know,
journalism
of different kinds. Right?
If you're doing journalism in a country where journalists are not that as favorable to the governing parties as they could be. Let's put it like that.
Yeah. Thanks for helping me out there. Yeah. So I think they were really impressed by the fact that even, happy to know even beforehand that extensions could lead to being tracked, because they were not aware of that. And they were like, yeah, okay, fine. How could this be problematic?
Yeah.
And when I explained it to them, like, so for example, you are using an extension which, for example, I come from India and I install an extension which converts English language to Hindi, for example, right? And if this is observable, then somebody definitely knows my nationality or, you know, ethnicity for that matter.
Yeah.
So it doesn't exactly give my name away, but it does tell or give away a personal bit of information which I never intended to leak. Right? So that's the bit of information that could potentially be leaked out through the kind of extensions that you are using.
Okay. So there is like there is not sufficient isolation between the extension and the web page you're visiting. So it's reporting back too much, basically.
Yeah, I mean, there are various ways by which an extension could be fingerprinted. And of course, we were not the first one to look into this. But we looked into a kind of vector which is extremely popular and extremely important to extensions. why are they there? They are there to execute code, mm-hmm. right? And what we kind of investigated there was, do these extensions leave behind execution traces, okay. which are observable? In the sense that if they execute a piece of JavaScript like console log in the web page, does this lead to fingerprinting? Actually, yes, because this was executed in the context of the web page itself. So web page could listen to these invocations and try and create a profile of all the JavaScript that these extensions executed.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out, which is also kind of expected, that extensions behave differently. Because why would you install 10 extensions which just translate from English to Hindi? You would only have one. So, yes. That's what we looked into, and we found out that over 3,000 extensions, I think, we looked into Mozilla and Chrome extensions both, mm-hmm. and we found like over 3,000 extensions to be just fingerprintable through their execution traces itself.
Okay. Were these like mostly niche ones, or is like big popular extensions that have a lot of users?
If I have to remember some of these names, I think one of them was Malwarebytes even. Okay. Yeah. Which is like, you know, an extension typically used by people to thwart or, you know, block suspicious websites or JavaScript.
Yeah.
And the problem there would be like if a website knows that, you know, a Malwarebytes extension is installed, they can just cloak their behavior. Like mm-hmm. they can just not load the malicious script. Same goes for Adblock. I think we had one of these popular Adblock mm-hmm. extensions. I don't remember the name because there's so many with similar names. And then the problem there, of course, is like if you know that there's an AdGuard extension or Adblock extension, you might have seen these pages. Please disable your ad blocker so that we can load the content. Mm-hmm. Right. So these things happen.
Okay. But current browsers are obviously not equipped to like kind of protect users from this fingerprinting.
Yeah, I think it goes back to the point what we discussed during like talking about the security headers project, and like it goes to the privacy side of things as well. The point is that these extensions are legitimate in most cases, and they are just doing what they promise their users to do.
Yeah.
And doing that, they leak out information or bits of information which was never their intention.
Mm-hmm.
And this is then, you know, observed by malicious websites or trackers or fingerprinters to just kind of build a profile of their users subsequently.
Yeah.
And that's problematic.
Okay.
So the question or the problem there is that shall we just stop using extensions?
Yeah.
That's probably not the solution. It's just more, you know, browser level problem. We don't have clear isolation so much between the web browser and, you know, mm-hmm. the extensions running, which kinds of create a problem here.
Okay, so in your last two papers, you have looked into the technical risks, what's actually happening, what are extensions doing, what are the risks for users, and you found out what developers are doing wrong. But in your latest study, you turned to these developers. You actually focused on the people who are writing these extensions, and you talked to them. Maybe we can discuss this a little bit, because that is the paper you will be presenting at the USENIX this year. So why was it important for you to include this user study of the actual developers that are writing the extensions in your research?
Yep, exactly. I think like talking about the two prior works kind of, you know, really helped shape like what exactly was the motivation there, because A, we wanted to look at behavior of legitimate extensions or potentially legitimate extensions, why they still create security and privacy problems. And then B, we spoke to developers, but on a small scale. For example, we found out 1,000 extensions to be doing something with security headers. And then we also found 3,000, you know, extensions to be being fingerprinted. And we reached out to these developers. Of course, we did not have like a very high number of responses, but we had some ideas. In the sense that there could be many more reasons than we actually anticipated. So we thought it's necessary to at least understand from the developer's perspective why they do what they do.
Mm-hmm.
And to kind of, you know, have a comprehensive understanding of this whole issue with benign but buggy browser extensions, as we call it.
Mm-hmm.
In our group.
Benign but buggy, which is a nice alliteration.
Yes. Yeah, I guess this is going to be the title of my thesis at some point. But
nice.
yeah, So we wanted to really understand from the developer's perspective, yeah, because of course people can have their own kind of opinions and assumptions that developers just do it for, you know, for the fun of it, or yeah, they just don't want to be secure and private in some sense. Same goes for users. Users can't be trusted and such. I have different opinions. I wanted to really understand what developers think through. And that was the motivation behind, you know, kind of, you know, interviewing these developers myself and yeah, try and understand the bits and pieces that goes through their development process itself. Yeah.
So there's a lot of insights to be gained from not just looking at their code, but actually talking to them.
Yeah, I mean, with technical measurements, which basically is like one of the things that I do on a daily basis, it tells us what is happening,
yeah,
but it doesn't tell us why yeah, something is happening,
sure,
or how can we make this yeah, better, because we don't have the clear picture or, you know, holistic picture there.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, you already hinted at it a few times, so would it be fair to say that your main or one of your main takeaways is that most of these developers don't do it on purpose to risk their users, machines, or data?
Yes, that would be one of the takeaways, one yeah, of the many takeaways, I would say, because when I actually spoke to these at least 21 of the developers mm-hmm, that we interviewed, there were kind of different kind of dimensions that opened up.
Mm-hmm.
So I think broadly speaking, one of the major takeaway or one of the major pattern that we saw was extension developers do know some of the extremely popular threats that could, you know, kind of is problematic with the extension yeah, ecosystem in itself. Like, you know, they could modify security headers, or they could be susceptible to, you know, privilege escalation or different kinds of attack that could happen on the client side. But the problem there was they don't have enough resources to actually look into them
yeah,
and try and make their extension secure or private, mm-hmm, private by design. So A, the effort itself is like extremely high.
Yeah.
And then B, the amount of resources that they are exposed to is not enough or not helpful enough per yeah, se, which kind of motivates them to actually spend more and more time in this direction.
So what kind of developers are we talking about? Are those people that develop these extensions as their job, as a product? Or are we more talking about like open source developers that do that in their free time to give something back to the community? Or, I don't know, someone has a fun idea what a browser extension could do and they just say, okay, maybe others could use that as well.
Yep, glad that you asked, because we had different kinds of developers itself. So for example, I remember the person we interviewed from Canada, they've been doing browser extension development for like past 10 years, and they come from arts background, if I remember mm-hmm, correctly. But they're monetizing their extension. So they're okay, not doing out of, you know, fun and business, yeah, out of fun.
Yeah.
So they're doing it for business. They earn money. And I think, if I remember correctly, it's their sole source of income. So
that
was pretty interesting to me because, you know, you don't have to have like a technical background or a computer science background mm-hmm, to be a browser extension expert.
Yeah.
And, but then it correlates with, you know, the security and privacy side of knowledge. And if you, well, like how much effort and, you know, time yeah, that you want to give to extension development yeah, when it also comes with, you know, monetization and sure, business side of things.
And there's always a discussion to be had of how much about privacy and security do you actually learn in your career when you start coding, when you learn it at a university, or when you just, I don't know, self-teach you by watching YouTube videos, which a lot of people do. So,
yeah, I totally agree with you there. I mean, although we did not find really differential behavior there
yeah,
because we had, like, as I mentioned, like different kind of people who were like, let's say, college dropouts, who were working in a security organization that built browser extensions, who were running their own business, as I mentioned, without mm-hmm, prior knowledge of computer science per se. And then some really motivated physicists
okay,
trying to run their startup and such.
Yeah.
So we had kind of, you know, various people from diverse background, I would say. But it did not really pan out in the sense that their background or, you know, the educational background per se
okay,
kind of, you know,
yeah,
So there wasn't like a clear correlation that someone who's self-taught will do a lot of dangerous stuff.
Yes.
Yeah, makes sense. Okay. Is it fair to say that most of these developers didn't actually realize that they might be putting their users at risk, which is something you already hinted at?
Yes. I mean, they were under the assumption that they're doing a fair job of looking after their users.
Yeah.
Because during the interview, we kind of asked them like, hey, do you know about certain threats that comes with installing an extension, or what sort of issues that you would kind of think before installing an extension on your own machine, or, you know, things that goes through your head when you're writing a piece of code and, you know, updating your extension, or even trying to onboard new users for your extension on the store and such. So they kind of hinted towards high level understanding of, like, you know, certain threats would evolve over time and these things are problematic. But then they were also quite confident that they're doing a fair job of looking, at least I would say 90% of these extension developers that we talked to, they were quite confident that they're doing a fair job.
Okay.
Of course, when, you know, towards the end of the interview, I think some of these opinions might have changed.
You have opened their eyes. Okay, that's interesting. It's very interesting. Again, was there anything that particularly surprised you in those conversations? Because also, from my point, I would imagine that that is also not something you do every day, right? Because a user study is something special.
Yes, exactly. So, I mean, I don't do developer studies or, you know, human-centric studies every day. My forte would be technical measurements, yes. Yeah. But I think it kind of gave a lot of new ideas in terms of like what actually people are doing. Because we, when we talk about web, for example, there are so many vulnerabilities, so many threats that we have, you know, heard of in the past. And same goes for browser extensions, because, you know, malicious browser extensions and such, they could inject ads and so much. But when it comes to benign extensions or benign extension developers, so one of the surprising thing for me there was a developer mentioned a very cool hack that I didn't know.
Okay.
To bypass a few of the restrictions of the Chrome Web Store put in place.
Okay.
Just so that their extension could be extremely modular.
Okay.
So that they don't have to update an extension every now and then, which is in itself a very tedious process. They have to write a form, fill up a form, and then, you know, it takes a while for the extension to be updated on the store and such. So they kind of exploited a cool hack to just reduce the kind of the amount of effort that goes into update the extension and made it modular. And this person who I'm talking about has, you know, worked in information security industry for like past 35 years.
Okay.
And that was extremely surprising for me that, you know, there are things that people know and are not doing, hopefully, exploiting them for malicious reasons.
Yeah.
But
for actually for their own sake of like being a little lazy, I'd call it.
Yeah, that would be a nice way to summarize that, I hope. So, yeah.
No, I mean, you might also argue for it being more efficient, but I could imagine that it might also open the door to some shenanigans that you wouldn't want, because I can imagine that like the update process on the Chrome Web Store is there for a reason, right?
Yes, exactly. I mean, it's basically gateway, right? It's basically the check gateway for all the extensions on the store. I think there are so many issues. I mean, on top, there would be ethical issues itself, right? Why would you allow certain extensions to operate in a way that is not, or that is violating the store principles?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's debatable.
Yeah, yeah. But I think it's actually something we have to talk about, because as you said, the Chrome Web Store and the Mozilla Web Store are probably the two most famous ones that you looked at. So they do have rules on what you can do in your browser extensions, what kind of extensions you can actually release into the wild. What do you think? Is it like is it also on them to invent better policies, and tools for the whole ecosystem that it gets more secure as a whole?
Yes, this was also one of the very important takeaways from our study, because we also talked to the developers about like the whole experience of, you know, them being building extensions for a while now. Like, how do they feel about this whole ecosystem growing, and are there any problems that they face? And actually, there were a few reported really important ones. I would say the development fatigue is a problem in the sense that if it takes so much effort to build the extensions in the right functional way that the developer would want to, like be it just the resources, right resources not being available, or just that the, you know, the Chrome or the Mozilla browser itself is so difficult to handle that it's so problematic, it's so exhausting to build the functionality, people don't care about security because you know they're just happy with the functionality. So that in itself was a problem that people reported, that right kind of resources are not available sometimes, both for functionality and security and privacy. But then also Chrome being the browser ecosystem, browser vendors not being extremely transparent about everything is also quite problematic.
Okay.
Because then developers wouldn't know what works and what doesn't. Because one day they submit an extension and then it gets passed.
Yeah.
And the other day, same extension gets flagged for whatever reasons.
Yeah.
And then it becomes an issue of transparency or how the whole protocol works in itself.
Okay.
That's actually one of the major concerns that we heard from many, many developers.
Okay.
And then since you mentioned Chrome and Mozilla, we are talking about two vendors already. And they kind of also have some deviations in terms of, you know, the restrictions, the regulations, how the extension should be submitted, plus also the APIs in itself, like they might behave differently. So basically developers have to adapt to it and then it adds to the fatigue.
So if you are developing for both browsers because you want to have like a higher market share,
yes,
you're making money. Yeah, it's like developing for two game consoles. It's
yes, which is very different from developing a website, right? Because you develop a website and it's fine. It works. Yeah. It mostly works for everything. Yeah. So these are the problems that, you know, it's not really so much technical when you're writing a piece of code, but it adds from, or it comes from the whole ecosystem in itself, because these are just, you know, contributing to the problem space in itself.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So there is work to be done also by the browser vendors. They have to, offer more support to developers to make this, this whole ecosystem, as you've put it, more secure.
Right? Yeah.
Okay.
I have to say this here, that we also reached out to, you know, these browser vendors like Chrome, Mozilla, Opera, Brave even, and Safari, of course.
Yeah.
Trying to, you know, convey all the information and everything that we got from the developers just to make them, you know, realize what could be the pain points that they could address. Or maybe they have a very legitimate reasons why certain things work the way they work at the moment, right?
Yeah, sure.
Maybe it's just a matter of communication to the developers in a way that they could perceive it well.
Yeah, right? Putting these people at a table and like just give them some chance to actually talk about what the problems are from both points of views.
Yeah, that was exactly also one of the points. Glad that you mentioned yourself. So I think with this whole transition of, so there's this transition going on or has gone in the past few years from Manifest V2, which is like an old extension development standard, to the new one.
Okay.
And this kind of bugged a lot of extension developers because it directly interfered with their functionality.
Okay.
And then there was like, you know, whole discussion about how this could have been communicated or executed versus how it actually happened.
Yeah.
So I think this miscommunication or, you know, unidirectional communication was like something that was also problematic and reported.
Yeah, which is very problematic because a lot of these developers are giving functionality to browsers that browser developers don't actually have to code themselves, right? So it should be, should go into both directions, I think.
Yeah, there are other things which goes neglected in many times, in many cases. Like, you know, I develop a browser extension and publish it.
Yeah.
I might be earning some money, but it doesn't really give so much all the time. Like it doesn't let me earn so much money that I can, you know, just sustain on that extension. So it's not like a monetary source for me. So if the whole process itself is easy, then it adds to the motivation. Otherwise, it adds to the problem. It adds to, you know, the laziness.
Yeah.
So I think the problem of incentive itself is also something that needs to be addressed because Chrome, or, you know, I think to quote some of our participants' words, browsers do not have any incentive to, you know, just allow extensions. That's why they are not really focusing on things.
Okay.
I don't know how true or untrue this whole statement is, but if this is like a common perception, then security and privacy would be the compromise that developers would opt for, unfortunately.
Okay, so the ecosystem as a whole has to get better to for developers to just, to just gain them the space to and time to actually think about privacy and security and how they might be hurting their users, even if it's just in an unintentional way.
Yep, totally.
All right. So, but all of that, what does that mean for regular users? What's your advice? Should we be more careful about the extensions we install? What do you tell our listeners? Like, how can they be sure that they're not losing data or losing some privacy over a browser extension?
Okay, one thing that I would like to mention here, like very strongly, is that I'm not trying to scare away people from browser extensions. That's not my goal. I think with time we have progressed to a better ecosystem, better, you know, process or how people could use browser extensions. So for example, I use myself some of them.
Yeah.
And I think it's extremely important to be cautious, just like how you would be cautious about, you know, receiving a funny email by, I don't know, Sten Bock, who is not my supervisor, but Ben Stock is.
Yeah.
Right? So just like other web problems that you might, you know, have heard of or be cautious about, I think being cautious about browser extensions, like what you're installing, just check the description of what it is supposed to do versus maybe try and observe what it actually does on a few days, like on the first few days. And then very important element nowadays that, you know, both Chrome and Mozilla are trying to enforce as a web extension architecture itself is like an extension could be limited to only certain websites that they're supposed to work on.
Okay.
And they don't have to actually work on or, you know, monitor all the websites that you kind of visit on your browser. Yeah. And users can very much be, you know, knowledgeable about this and limit the behavior. So if you're using Google Translate, you can limit the behavior to only allow that extension to work when you click on that.
Okay.
I mean, this is like, it could sound technical, but it's actually really straightforward if you want to Google about this, like how I can limit extension behavior. I think there are a couple of really helpful Chrome blocks and such about this.
Yeah.
And you could limit this. And it's like, you know, hardly takes 30 seconds.
Okay.
It's not even.
So it's just limits a little bit, like, so the extension does not have to read everything you're doing on the web.
Yes, exactly. It limits the threat surface. Like it might still be doing something funny when you click on that extension, but it just limits your damage surface.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. And otherwise it might just probably be a good idea to not install every single funny extension you see. I remember there were some extensions that switched out politicians' names for something else.
Yes, I know about that extension too.
So it might be a good idea to think about if you actually need these, right? So
yes, absolutely. I mean, don't get tempted with certain keywords. So for example, I know that there are there's this hype about AI assistants nowadays, which basically just, you know, allow you to write prompts and then do funny things on website, like, you know, get the pictures and stuff. And I think it's not my research, it's somebody else's research. They looked into this and they found a lot of, you know, a couple of extensions doing really funny things. And I think this is problematic because from user's perspective, it's very tempting, kind of, you know, the essence of browser extension is the fact that they can provide so many functionalities. Yeah. And that's extremely tempting.
Yeah.
And I think what you kind of hinted towards before is like, just like install extensions that are extremely important.
Yeah.
Otherwise, do not. I think that's a pretty good advice, which you managed to give yourself without any help from us. So.
Yeah, I mean, you kind of nudged us into that direction because, but it's, it sort of brings us back to the beginning. You said that they are very powerful, but with, as Spider-Man said, with great power comes great responsibility.
Yeah.
Please don't sue me, Marvel. But yeah, I think what he said is true.
I agree. Yeah.
All right, then. That was very insightful. Thank you very much. I'm sure your colleagues in Seattle will enjoy hearing about your new research. But for now, I cannot let you go before I give you some quick fire questions. And my first one is right on topic, because you already hinted at it. What browser extensions do you still use and trust?
I use a couple of them on a daily basis, like Malwarebytes. I kind of trust the extension. I hope they live to my trust.
Yeah.
I use them. I use Google Scholar because, okay. Well, I'm doing academic research. Yeah. The good thing is that it only works when I click, and I use Google Translate sometimes.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that's all.
All right. Yeah, you kept it fairly limited. Okay. What is the most surprising thing that you have learned in your cybersecurity research so far?
Yeah, I think this was this discussion about, you know, developers coming, providing their insights from different dimensions. This was something extremely eye-opening for me, because I would not assume, you know, so I would just take away whatever was fed to me, like, yeah, users are, you know, not careful, developers are not careful. I think this whole idea about, you know, this different perspective that I learned over the years when I, you know, during my PhD time, I think this has been the best kind of, you know, learning that I've gotten so far.
Yeah. For you, there is a case to be made for information security researchers actually considering the other side of the coin.
Totally. I mean, I know that, you know, some of my colleagues in the usable security group, they very actively hear about, you know, the security and privacy aspects from users themselves. Like, I think that same thing goes from developers, because we can reason about so many things, that certain things are happening. HTTP is not being enforced, or, you know, I mean, HTTPS is all everywhere nowadays, but same goes for email clients being bad or phishing being prominent. But what do users think about it? Are they being cautious about it? I think it's extremely important to hear from the other side.
Mm-hmm. Okay, interesting. If you could instantly solve one cybersecurity problem right now, what would it be?
Ah, that I will have to take a few seconds for that because,
can only choose one.
Yeah, exactly. That's really tempting. I think I will try to solve the problem of over-relying on AI, because that's the hot topic, because AI is everywhere, and I think it comes with a lot of security and privacy problems. Mm-hmm. And I would like to solve that problem. I totally agree with the point that AI is really helpful for many, many reasons, but I also would want to, you know, kind of contain it in a way that it doesn't really break the security and privacy barriers. And that is something I would like to, you know, kind of hop into the bus and then solve that problem for good.
Because security and privacy, as you've put it, is often an afterthought when things go fast.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Which takes us back. Yeah. Still, next question goes right into that direction. AI can now take over one part of your work as a researcher. What will you happily hand off to it?
I've been trying to. Data analysis, because, you know, we do large scale measurements. We collect a lot of data, like gigabytes or even sometimes terabytes of data. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's painful to, you know, write a fabulous script which covers all the edge cases. I know that some people are already, or some tools are already available, you know, data pre-processing and post-processing. But I think it's a really nice candidate for, you know, just AI to hop in and say that, hey, here be the data and here be the results. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Yeah, that would be very tempting and sounds like a dream, you know. But now that your time at CISPA is almost over, what does the future hold in store for you?
I think I really enjoyed my work doing my work and doing research. Mm-hmm. So I'm still in academia. I would still like to continue. So I think that's the way to go for. And I'm going to join as a postdoc at MPI Security and Privacy in September.
Okay.
With Camilla Troncoso. And as I said, like, I think there's something that I could still contribute in this area towards this whole research line of security and privacy. And I'm really looking forward to maybe step out in a broader sense, like not just focus on broader browser extensions anymore, but look into, for example, AI and you know, other things.
Yeah, lots of work to be done. I mean, if you have listened to a few episodes of this podcast, you know that there's like a never ending list of security problems that we are currently working on right now, or might be working on in the future. So,
yes, totally.
All right, Shubham, thank you very much. And I wish you all the best in your future research career. And you never know. Maybe we'll meet again at CISPA or at a conference. So thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Tobias. Thanks for having me. I really enjoyed my time here.
So that's it for this episode of CISPA TLDR. Big thanks again to Shubham for joining us and sharing his insights into the fascinating world of browser extensions. If you want to learn more about Shubham's work, check out the links in the show notes. And if you enjoyed this episode, make sure to follow or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And leave us a rating if you're feeling generous. It really helps others find the show. I'm Tobias Ebelshäuser. Thanks for listening and see you next time when we'll dive into the next big topic in cybersecurity and AI without all the complicated stuff.